Chapter 7 Faces. Cavity 29617 was a hole space, a long and slightly irregular chamber that ran beside and under one of the main plasma engine housings. It was low priority and had only the rudiments of light and atmospheric processing. From the junk and dust, it was an attic or basement or whatever they called such things on starships, that hadn't been used in a few centuries. That suited Mert. Cavity 29617 was out of the way. It wasn't one of the big holes reserved for training exercise and technique work, and it was far smaller than the hangar decks used for parade and mass drill. It was narrow and long, which gave him some range. It had a breeze running through it from the processor vents, which gave it a cross-draft and made it feel a bit like outdoor conditions. And no one went there, so no one could see him being useless. Since his injury in Monthax, years of practice had failed to yield any results. Mert had tried. He'd shown a persistence and resolve rare even by marksman standards. He had worked to rebuild his shattered skill. The only thing he was sure of was that he should have given up trying a long time ago. But Larkin, his old friend and rival, was in another of his mad moods. He had invested his manic attention in Mert, and Mert didn't have the heart to let him down. He knew he would let him down, but he wanted to be seen to make an effort, so it didn't seem like he'd just let it happen. A few dozen hours extra target practice. What could that hurt? It proved that Larkin was his friend, and he was willing to humour his friend's confidence. It meant that when he finally had to say he couldn't do it, he'd know that he couldn't do it. He had proof. Evidence. He'd tried, so the failure was softened. Mert had the bolt-action rifle Larkin was using to train him and a box of shells. Larkin had yet to explain the full significance of the old mech weapons in terms of the mission profile. A long las was a far superior weapon. Only a few people in the Tanith First knew what they were heading into and what they might be expected to do when they got there. Mert knew Larkin himself only understood bits of it, just enough to train specialisms. The one and only thing everybody knew was that they were not heading for a happy place. The next mission was going to be damn hard work. Mert had lined up some old tin cups, pots and lubricant canisters as targets, and set himself up in a seated position, his back against the cavity wall to take his weight, the rifle braced across a stand he'd rigged from an old metal bench. He then adjusted and finessed the rest using a couple of the sand socks every marksman carried in his pouch. He had a simple optic scope for range finding, but he used it separately, lining up an angle, then putting the scope aside to take final aim along the iron sights of the gun. He allowed for air drift and the rifle's innate inclination to dip and rise on discharge. The weapon had a tiny left-hand bias, which Larkin had corrected for by adjusting the sights with a watchmaker's screwdriver. Mert let his tension out, then let all the air in his lungs go. A long, slow exhalation, so that even the stir of respiration or the tremble of suspended breathing wouldn't affect the aim. The only thing he couldn't reduce was the infinitesimal quake of his heartbeat, so he timed to fire between beats. Beat, line up the shot. Beat, check the line. Beat, fire. The shot echoed down the cavity. The round clipped the lip of a tin pot and made it judder. He'd been aiming for a mark on the pot about a middle finger's distance away from what he'd actually hit. Hopeless. Faithing hopeless. To even be considered for a lanyard, he'd have had needed to partially overlap the target spot. That is a poor shot. Mert jumped. It wasn't so much that someone had surprised him. It was that someone so big had miraculously appeared in his line of sight. He scrambled up, knocking over the stand. Surprise gave way to fear. The white scar squinted down the range, then looked back at the human with a rifle.
"Very poor," said Sarath. "Pathetic. Why do you even bother?" "Speak up. Are you simple?"
"I'm practicing."
Sarath frowned. He coughed and then rubbed the tip of his nose with armoured fingers that could crush bone.
"You will be here a long time," he said.
"I've been here a long time already," said Mert.
Sarath nodded. He held out his hand.
"Give it to me."
His voice reminded Mert of Jago. Dry winds gusting forlornly through dusty valleys, sandstone eroded by the air. Mert handed him the rifle. Sarath took it, a stick, a toy. He sighted down the barrel, holding it one-handed, as if to check the barrel was actually straight. The trigger guard was entirely too small for his fingers. He handed it back.
"I cannot use that. Shoot again."
"Sir..."
"Again."
Mert reached to reset the stand and pick up the sand socks.
"Do not bother with that. Just take a good shot from where you are. Just aim and shoot."
Mert slunk the bolt, ejected the shell case, took another round out of the box at his feet and chambered it. He glanced at the space marine. The giant was simply staring down at him, impassive. Mert put the gun up to his cheek, chose a tin cup, sighted, breathed out, and fired. The shot clipped the cup hard enough to spin it off the block. It made several dull, hollow sounds as it bounced on the hold deck.
"Still pathetic," said Sarath.
He looked at Mert.
"Good enough for guard fire on a field, I suppose, but not precise enough for anything else."
Mert didn't know what to say. The white scar was still looking at him, but his mind was far away. It felt to Mert like the space marine was precisely playing back at a painstakingly slow rate the memory of Mert taking the shot, so he could analyse it. He stopped, looked back at Mert, and then suddenly reached out a hand, grabbing Mert by the jaw and throat. The hand turned Mert's head to the side. Mert struggled and choked.
"This jaw, this augmetic repair, it is your problem," said Sarath. "You are being defeated by your own concentration. Your focus is so intense that as you fire the gun, it stimulates the neurons in your jaw and you twitch."
"I twitch."
"Just as you fire, your jaw clenches."
Sarath let him go.
"It is physically impossible for you to shoot well."
Mert swallowed.
"Come back again tomorrow," said Sarath.
The main refectory was in the mid-decks. The walls and floor were plated with dull galvanised ceiling, and the metal tables and benches were bolted in place. There was a constant clatter of utensils and dishes against metal surfaces, and the air frequently fumed with steam from the galley. Wilder picked at the slab on the plate in front of him. Merrin sat down opposite. He had a covered dish of food and a tin beaker. Merrin drank the contents of the beaker in one swallow, then slid the empty beaker across the table to Wilder. Wilder looked at the cup. Merrin took a fork out of his top pocket and began to eat.
"How's yours, Jacob?"
he asked pleasantly. Wilder didn't reply. He picked up the empty beaker and looked in it. There was a little brown paper wrap in the bottom of the cup. "What's that?"
"Happiness," replied Merrin, still eating.
"For me?" Merrin chewed to empty his mouth before replying.
They'll make our mutual friend Blenner happy, which is the same thing.
Wilder put the cup down again, as if he had no intention of touching the little bag of narcotic pills.
Where are they from?
Coston, said Merrin.
He grows them on a special tree, does he?
Do you want them or not? Merrin leant his elbow on the table, rocking the fork in his hand. He stared at Wilder, chewing another mouthful.
Do you know where we are going? He asked.
No, said Wilder.
Merrin sighed. Yes, I suppose if I don't get told, you certainly wouldn't.
What does that mean?
It means some people get on and some don't, Jacob. Some people enjoy favour.
You were right, what you said to Gendler about Gaunt's brat.
Why would I have lied? Asked Wilder. No reason.
Gaunt's got my adjutant running around, looking after the spoiled little brat. The kid's no soldier, not old enough. Doesn't look like he's done a hand's turn in his life. Certainly never fought. He'd blow away if the arch-enemy so much as farted.
Got his own cabin, though.
His own cabin?
Merrin grinned. Can you believe that? Gaunt pretends he wants him treated like all the others. Like every common lasman. But then his psycho bitch lifeguard. Because every common lasman has a lifeguard, don't they? Then his lifeguard says he can't share a general billet with other men. Oh, no. She insists she needs him behind a door she can defend.
She said this to Gaunt?
Of course not, said Merrin. She says it to me. See how he did that? He declares that we are going to treat the brat like everyone else, then makes it my problem, so that the stink of favouritism doesn't stick to him.
What did you do? Asked Wilder.
Gave him the small-end cabin on the officer quarter block, near mine.
Wilder sat back and sipped from his beaker.
Doesn't that undermine Gaunt's wishes? He asked. Gaunt's passive-aggressive. He says one thing, but he means another. Come on, Wilder. You know how this goes. If I'd stuck to my guns and made the boy sleep in the general barrack, I'd have suddenly found myself getting all the shit details. It would have become E-Company's turn to hose out the latrines or spearhead the next attack.
So Gaunt gets his way and it looks like someone else's idea, said Wilder.
You're beginning to see the imperial truth, grinned Merrin.
Why'd you hate him so much?
Merrin shrugged. He killed my world, my life. That deserves payback sooner or later. But it's not that so much. Everything I have, everything I've built up, I've made it for myself. Company command, rank, privilege, influence. I did it all myself. I don't get things handed to me. I'm not part of his inner circle.
Who is?
Collier, Baskerville, McCall, even Rowan these days, because apparently Rowan left his balls behind on Geryon. I don't owe Gaunt anything. He owes me everything, and he's never going to give it. So I'm taking everything I can.
What about Gendler?
Gendler's the same, said Merrin, cutting another mouthful with the side of his fork. Gaunt took his life away. You have to understand. Didi was a rich man on Vergast. Up spine, noble blood. Lost it all in the Zuikin War. Family, property. And what choice did he get? Live in poverty in Vervenhive during the long years of post-war rebuild and deprivation, hoping that one day his legal claims for compensation might be heard in the assizes. Or take the act of consolation, where the dispossessed could join the guard and start a new life.
Gendler made his choice, said Wilder.
Yes, he did. He said goodbye to his old life, to what family he had left, and came to serve Gaunt. And has Gaunt ever recognised him? Seen fit to make him more than sergeant? Did he cut ties with his relatives forever? But Gaunt? They bring his Fething son through the warp to be with him. He gets to bring his past with him. He gets to have a life. He gets to have a family. The Emperor's Imperial Guard makes sure of that. We sacrifice so he gets to be what he is. It's always about favour, Jacob. Just like I said, it's always about favour and who you know. Welder thought about it. Merrin watched his face. I know you feel it too, Jacob, said Merrin. Just like us. Your brother, his command, his regiment. And look how they treat you. Like a joke. Welder put down his fork. Life's unfair, he said. That's all.
Right. So you make it fairer, said Merrin.
How?
Well, Didi said we should kill Gaunt's kid, said Merrin.
He smiled at the horrified expression in Welder's face.
Calm down. Didi's just a bit angry.
It's the Vervenhive connection. Gaunt's not even up spine blood, and he gets noble favour. Seriously, it's a joke.
We're not going to murder anybody.
Didi had sunk a few. He was just being toxic. There are less dramatic things we can do that will be just as satisfying.
Like what? Asked Welder.
Merrin nodded to the beaker.
You take those, he said. You put them to work. That's a start.
He got up, stepped off the bench, and picked up his plate.
Where I came from, he said, men were raised as hunters. Hunters plan, they stalk, they take their time. You know what a hunter's greatest weapon is, Jacob?
No.
Patience, said Merrin.
Eyes that were remarkably good copies of Trooper Paul Coran's watched the shift change at the deep hold containment area. It had taken a few hours to find out where on board the prisoner was being held. The armoured well of an old battery magazine had been converted into a cell. That was smart thinking. The battery magazines had thicker walls than the discipline brig. The enemy had placed security measures in the hands of a dedicated squad. The squad, 1st Platoon of E Company, had been granted Commissariat S status. They were also regimental veterans, die-hard ghosts, so there was little chance of co-opting or turning one. Coran watched from the shadows. He checked the approaches from the ways to and from the cell, the routines. Where did food come from? How was it brought? How many times a shift? What opportunities were there to intercept and tamper with it? At any time, there were four of the S Company guards around, two outside the hatch, two in the tank. Coran, at least the thing that was playing the role of Paul Coran, was patient. Observation times were limited because Coran's absence from the quarters deck would be noticed at certain times. He didn't want to give up the identity, more particularly, he didn't want the state of alert to be heightened because a trooper had gone missing. But he was also keenly aware that his opportunities, and he had to choose one quickly, had fast approaching expiry dates. Leonard poured himself a second mug of caffeine and fantasised about slugging a dash of Amasek in it. He had never been comfortable making shift. The dayless nights and the nightless days, the dreams, the dislocation. He hadn't been sleeping well. The prospect of days or even weeks more did not fill him with relish. Give him a nice world and a straight fight instead. Actually, the fight could belong to someone else. Just a nice world would do. He took another disdainful look at the data slate he had been reading from. Excerpted pieces from the service record of Novobaski, pulled from the regimental archive. Welder had been right. Novobaski could certainly talk, for hours at a time. It was giving Blenner a headache. He took a pill. There were only a few of them rattling around in the bottle now. He didn't like to think of them as a crutch.
but he really didn't like to think of facing life without them. "You look terrible," said Fazekiel, sitting down at his table in the staff section of the refectory. "Is there no beginning to your charm?" asked Blenner. She grinned and began to arrange the food on her tray. She'd made them serve items like slab and veg paste on separate dishes. There was a lot of fibre and a large canister of thick, grey nutrient drink rather than caffeine. She saw Blenner staring. "Healthy mind in a healthy body," she said.
"In an entirely miserable and deprived body, maybe," he replied. He looked at her drink. "What's wrong with caffeine? That stuff will kill you. And what's with the separate dishes?"
"I don't like things to touch," said Fazekiel. "It's messy and undisciplined."
"Really?"
Despite the hour and his heavy head, Blenner grinned. Luna Fazekiel was always immaculate. He'd never known anyone adhere to dress code so exactly, even by the demanding standards of the commissariat. She was obsessively clean and punctual, obsessively regimented and organised. "Something funny?" she asked. She was a handsome woman and a highly effective commissar, but control smoked off her like blood fog off a power blade. There was no margin for error with her, no give. The troop mass saw that in her, and that's what made them respect her.
"No, no," he said.
"Thought you'd be at the inspection," she said. He looked up. "Weren't you the one who postponed it?" she asked.
"Ah," he said.
"Where is this trooper?" asked Ada.
"Sir, I don't know, sir," replied Yerolimu, rigidly at attention.
Edur looked at Wilder.
"Comment, Captain?" he asked.
"The trooper's absence is unauthorised," said Wilder, staring at the empty court.
In the hold space around him, the bandsmen of his command stood beside their made-up cots in perfect rows. He knew they would all have been looking at him if they hadn't had eyes front.
"There's the absence itself," said Edur, "and then there's your Sergeant Major's ignorance."
"I think they're connected," said Wilder.
"If Sergeant Major Yerolimu knew where the trooper was, the absence wouldn't be unauthorised."
"Don't get clever, Captain," said Baskerville.
Wilder could see that Major Baskerville was uncomfortable. From what he'd heard, the Major was a fair man who was probably unhappy seeing the good name of Belladon put under pressure.
"What's the trooper's name?"
asked Eder.
"Corran, sir," said Yerolimu.
"I will issue a citation," said Ida. "It will be for both the trooper and..."
"Corran is shift sick,"
said Blenner. He'd walked into the hall behind the inspection party.
"It's a bad case," he added. "Afflicted a lot of personnel this time out. You had a touch of it yourself, didn't you, Captain?"
"Yes," said Wilder.
"I signed a chit and sent Corran along to the infirmary," said Blenner.
"The Sergeant Major was unaware," said Edo.
"Because I've only just done it, and I was coming to tell the Sergeant Major about it," said Blenner.
Edo stared at him for a second.
"That's the thing about surprise inspections," said Blenner pleasantly. "They don't fall at neatly punctuated moments."
"Very well," said Ida. "Let's carry on."
The inspection continued for another 40 minutes. When Ida and Baskerville were gone, Blenner took Wilder to one side.
"Find 2 or 3 troopers you can trust. That girl, for example. Get them to find Corran."
Wilder nodded.
"You didn't send him to the Medicaid, did you?"
"No," said Blenner.
He wrote out a permission slip, tore it off his workbook, and folded it.
"Get this to him, and tell him where he was supposed to be, fast. Then tell him to come and find me, and we'll make sure this never happens again."
"Thank you," said Wilder.
"Don't thank me. My neck's on the line too."
Wilder thought for a moment, and then took something out of his pocket.
Wondered if you could do anything with these," he said.
Blenner took the small bag of pills.
"What's this?"
he asked.
"I found them," said Wilder.
Where? Welder shrugged.
Could there be more of them?
Asked Blenner. Probably, said Welder. Troopers are always finding a way of getting their hands on stuff. I'm sure some might turn up again.
I see, said Blenner.
He looked at the little bag and put it in his coat pocket.
I'll take care of it, Captain.
Good, said Welder. I thought that would be for the best. Just thought we should keep it quiet. They looked around as Sergeant Major Urolamu approached them.
Begging your pardon, sirs, he said. Message just received. The full regiment's to assemble on the main excursion deck in an hour. The commander's going to address us.
I suppose now we're underway, said Welder.
We'll get to find out where we're going.
I suppose we do, said Blenner.
There was great activity through the mid-decks of the ship as the regiment assembled for the address. At his bridge position, Shipmaster Spiker watched his passengers bustling like hive insects through the oily tunnels and dank companionways. He adjusted settings and switched the picked view of several screens. People intrigued him. People who didn't live in the void like he did. It seemed so contained by the fabric of the ship, so penned in. They were cattle being transported to market. They did not inhabit the vessel the way he and his crew did. His seat was a worn leather throne mounted in a gilded carriage. There were two big banks of control levers at the end of each armrest. The mechanisms were so old that many of the levers had been replaced. New metal bars and handle tops seam welded onto the eroded or broken spurs of the originals. Even some of the replacements had begun to wear. Spiker adjusted the levers, and his chair, mounted on a long gimbal-jointed lifting arm, rose up out of the upper deck platform and extended out over the vast bridge. From there, he could sweep down and observe main console functions over the shoulders of key officers, or loft himself up into the domed roof to study the hololithic star map projection, or converse with the twitching, harnessed navigator. He'd been invited to attend the address. A note had been delivered from the Colonel Commissar fellow. He wouldn't attend. He knew where they were going. Besides, the warp was rough and troubled. There was a lively tide and unusual levels of dispersion and turbulence. He needed to be on the bridge, at his station, in case things got rough.
What's going on? Elodie asked Dower,
passing him in the bustling central line hall.
Review, he replied. Address. We get told our destination.
Really?
Asked Elodie.
This is the point of it all, said Dower.
The point where we commit.
The real start of the mission. Look, I've got to get on and get G Company assembled. I'll come and tell you everything later.
Everything? She asked.
I promise.
They moved off in opposite directions. Paul Corran stepped out of the shadows of a colonnade arch and merged with the flow of hurrying figures, just another hustling trooper. He'd heard what the captain had said. We get told our destination. Priorities had just changed again.
You! Are you there?
Corran stopped and turned slowly. Some of the personnel passing him bumped against him. 20 paces behind him, Commissar Edur was glaring at him.
Corran! Trooper Corran?
Yes, sir.
Come here, damn it!
Edur snapped, indicating a spot on the deck directly in front of him. The river of people around them parted and found other routes to take. No one wanted to get in the way of an Imperial Commissar, especially not one who was clearly aggravated. Furthermore, no one had seen the newcomer Edur raise his voice yet.
Right here, trooper,
Edur ordered. Corran hesitated a moment longer. He weighed his options and realised they all depended on him maintaining his deception. In full view like this, in front of dozens of regimental personnel, his options were drastically limited. He walked back to Edur and stood in front of him, hands behind his back. Edur wrinkled a lip.
Under the circumstances, said Edir quietly, I think an attitude of attention shows more respect. Corran snapped to attention. This isn't the infirmary, said Edir. Sir? I said this is a long way from the infirmary, trooper. Yes, sir. Your acceleration sickness got better then, did it? Asked Edir. You don't look sick to me. Or did the grace of the Beati and the God Emperor shine forth upon you and heal you?
May they live forever in our hearts and our minds, sir, said Corran.
Watch your tone.
Sir?
Let's see this slip, trooper, said Edir.
Slip, sir?
Your chit, trooper. The permission slip Commissar Blenner gave you.
I... Corran began. He paused. I believe I must have lost it, sir.
Let's go, trooper, said Edir. This way.
I've got to report for the review and address, sir, Corran said.
Move,
said Edir. Edir pointed and walked Corran off the central line hall onto one of the transverse access corridors. Edir stayed close behind Corran, a menacing escort. Two men ran past the other way, carrying a cargo crate between them.
I should go to the address, sir, said Corran.
Enough, trooper, said Edir.
It's mandatory. If I miss it, the captain will...
I said enough! You're already in trouble for not being where you were supposed to be.
But I...
Seriously, how deep do you intend to dig your way into this, Corran? Punishment squad deep? Flogging deep?
More men went by in the other direction, hurrying, buttoning up their jackets.
I just went to the infirmary, sir, said Corran. I can't miss the review.
I'm about out of patience with you, Corran, said Edir. I think you'll be looking at the inside of the brig for quite a time, while I fathom out why Commissar Blenner tried to protect you. People like you frustrate me, Corran. If you just faced up when I confronted you, I'd have probably let you off with a citation. But this blather, this effort to wriggle out, it's what dilutes the guard. You hear me? It's the kind of rot thinking that eats out the heart of a good regiment. You're a weak man, Corran. There's no excuse for it.
I'm sick, sir, said Corran. He stopped walking.
You're not sick. Get on.
Corran shivered and groaned, as though something unpleasant had just undermined him on a gastric level.
Corran!
I'm going to throw up,
gasped Corran. He turned and blundered off the transverse into the narrow access tunnel of an engineering inspection bay, clinging to the wall and heaving.
Corran!
Edir strode after him. His hand went to his holster. Corran had gone a short way down the dank metal tunnel. There was a purr of heavy machinery from the bay up ahead. The light levels were much lower than out in the transverse, where people were still hurrying by. Corran leaned his forearm and his head against the machine metal wall plate, breathing hard. Edir drew his pistol and aimed it at the side of Corran's head.
You must think I'm a thrown-damned idiot if you think I'm going to fall for this play-acting, he said. This just escalated to serious charges, you worthless...
Corran snapped around. With a speed Edir could not explain or anticipate, Corran's raised hand caught his wrist, knocked the aim aside and propelled Edir backwards into the opposite wall of the tunnel. He hit hard, grazing the back of his head and driving the wind out of his lungs. Corran reversed his turn, embraced Edir's gun arm, extended it, and then broke the wrist. Edir howled in pain. Corran took the pistol out of the limp hand and tossed it into the engineering bay behind him. It was done. Pain shock alone would floor the commissar, and Usain Edir was a strong man. A deep sense of righteous indignation broke through his wash of pain and surprise. It was a reserve that had kept him alive on several battlefields, a focus that allowed him to push past the undermining fog of injury or confusion. He threw himself at Corran, leading with his left shoulder. They cannoned together, and Edir dragged Corran along a section of wall plate, splitting his lip and gouging his cheek. Corran barked out a snarl and drove his elbow back into Edir's collarbone. Edir smacked back against the opposite tunnel wall. He came at Corran again, leading with his good hand. Corran had turned to square up, head down, fists raised. As Edir surged forwards,
Corran swung a punch that caught Edur across the ear and drove him sideways. He stumbled into the end of the tunnel wall and staggered off it into the engineering bay. Corran came after him. He needed to control things again, quickly, before somebody passing along the traverse heard or saw what was happening. The bay was more out of the way than the tunnel. The purr of the machinery masked their sounds. A single servitor menial turned from an inspection panel to note the visitors to his workspace with uncomprehending eyes. Caliper digits flexed as it tried to process the interruption to its basic task functions. The centre of the bay area was a deep, through-deck shaft that accommodated the rising spire of an accumulator stack. The ancient brass rings and steel-cased capacitor rods whirred and rotated. Fronds of energy crackled down in the shaft below the iron handrail. Corran barged Edur across the bay and into the rail, twisting his back and damaging his lower spine. Edur cried out in pain, lashed out, and connected with his broken hand. The blow to the forehead was enough to make Corran flinch backwards, but the pain from the grinding bone made Edur gag and slump, his eyes and mouth wide, gasping like a landed fish. Corran kicked him in the chest, then again in the face, smashing Edur's head back so it bounced off the guardrail. Edur collapsed in an awkward heap against the rail, his legs bent under him. Corran stepped forwards to snap his neck and finish the game. He stopped dead, looking down the snout of Edur's pistol. Somewhere during the scramble, the commissar had got hold of it again. He was aiming it with his good hand, his broken hand curled like a dead fledgling against his chest. His head was swaying and blood was drilling from his mouth. He'd lost some teeth, and one eye was beginning to swell shut.
"Little bastard,"
Edur slurred. The surprise reversal made Corran lose control of his face for a second. The features rippled.
"What the hell are you?"
Edur asked. It was enough of a distraction. Corran punched, his fingers gathered into a beak shape. The inhuman force of the blow demolished Edur's face and exploded the nasal and brow bones back into his brain. The hand holding the pistol dropped heavily. Edur's pulverised face bowed forward as if in prayer. Blood pattered out of it in three or four separate streams. Corran straightened up. He could feel blood running from his own cheek and lip. He turned. The servitor had risen to its feet, agitated. Corran stepped forwards, grasped it by its ceramite jaw and cranium, and snapped its neck. He broke off one of the servitor's digital tools and used it to gouge out the unit's optics and burn out its visual memory core. Corran looked around. He peered over the rail and saw the long drop into the gloom of the exhaust sump at the foot of the stack. Without prevarication, he tipped Edur's body down the shaft, watched it tumble and deflect off lower guardrails, and then disappear. He threw the servitor in after it. He needed to get cleaned up. He needed to get to the excursion deck.
"They're present and correct," said Beltane. Gaunt nodded. He put on his cap, peak first, adjusted it, and took a calming breath. Then he walked in through the vast entry hatch. Beltane fell into step behind him, with an escort squad from A Company, led by Creed and McCall. The Armaduke's main excursion deck was a vast hangar space, with a floor plan equal to several parade grounds set end to end. Light shafted down from the lantern arrays, bolted in amongst the girder ribs of the roof. Large craft, such as troop carrier landers and cargo runners, had been towed to the far end, away from the forward space doors. Some were enclosed in cages of gantry scaffolding so that servitors and mechanicus crews could work on their maintenance. Small craft, the lighters and shuttles, had been hoisted up into the rafters on magnetic clamps and hung overhead like hunting trophies. On the port wing hinge assembly of one suspended Arvus, a two-headed eagle perched and glared balefully down at Gaunt as he advanced out into the open space of the deck. The entire regiment had assembled on the principal landing platform. The troopers were wearing operational uniforms rather than formal dress, but the clothes and kit had been cleaned and prepared to the highest standards. They were arranged in company blocks, with their officers to the fore of each section. A cantilevered through-deck elevator had been raised to form a podium in front of them. Company colours were displayed. Tanith, Vergast, Belladon. The retinue had been permitted to attend. They clustered around the doorway or filled the second and third-tier galleries of the deck's upper levels. As he walked out through them, Gaunt saw two faces he recognised. Dowersgirl, Elodie, aloof and vigilant. Madalena, dear beloved. "No representation from the Adeptus Astartes?" Gaunt asked Beltane quietly as they walked.
"They seem constantly occupied, sir,"
Beltane whispered back.
"It is reported to me that the Iron Snake spends all his time in relentless combat practice, and the Silver Guard does nothing but study schematic simulations."
"What about the White Scar?"
"No one knows, sir. He seems to be roaming the ship."
"And no representation from Spiker's crew?"
"I think they're busy doing shippy things, sir."
They came out onto the main platform ahead of the review, and Rowan, his eyes front, barked out a stern order. The regiment seamlessly came to attention with one ringing clash. At this signal, Sergeant Major Eurolamew raised his golden pace stick, and Trooper Perday tilted her head back, raised her helicon, and blasted out a pure, clean solo fanfare. Gaunt winced slightly. The playing was fine. In fact, it was perfect, and the sound remarkably uplifting. He just wondered when the Tanith First had become that sort of regiment, and when he had become that sort of commander. It had never been about ceremony. He stepped up onto the elevated platform, made the sign of the Aquila, and told the regiment to stand easy. "With this new strength," he said, in a voice that was used to carrying effortlessly, "already welcomed into our fold, we stand together for the first time." His eyes drifted across the sea of faces. They were attentive and still, but only a few betrayed any emotion. Bandauer could never hide that earnest hint of determination. Major Zukova, a new face for Gaunt, was positively glowing with pride. There was something wry and mischievous in Hlain Larkin's eyes, and it was as distinctive and familiar as the ever-present hint of dissatisfaction on Victor Hark's. Then there was Meritus Felix Chass. He was in the front rank of E, behind Merrin, flanked by Dallin Creed. Dallin, or Ludd, had procured a set of Tanith blacks and a camel cloak for him. He looked breakable and frail, like a child dressed up as a soldier. It was almost as if Dallin had brought his little sister out onto the parade ground. Chass looked a good 10 years younger than the youngest members of the company. With a slight pang and a curious sensation of surprise, Gaunt realised who Chass reminded him of. With that expression of resolution not to fail or let anyone down, Chass looked like a boy, the Hurricane boy, the cadet in the corner of regimental Picts of the fighting Hurricane 8th, standing between Sergeant Tannhouse and Commissar Oktar. "We have embarked and are underway," said Gaunt. "And, isolated by the shift, we no longer risk the dangers of loose talk in a home port. I can now tell you a little of the mission we are undertaking." No one moved, but he could sense their expectation. "From the accompany bonds, you know this endeavour will be direct and risky. We will be making a shipboard attack on an enemy facility. That facility is located in the Rimworld marginals, at a place called Salvation's Reach. Specialism briefings will begin immediately after this address, and section leaders will be informed of specific mission requirements. We have, according to the revised estimate, about a week of lead time before we translate and begin deceleration approach of the target area. However, an estimated 23 hours from now, we will translate to effect a conjunction with other battle fleet elements at Tavis Sun. This resupply is expected to last just a few hours, and is ship to ship. Unless this mission is altered or aborted, we will not see a friendly port until this work is complete." He raised his head slightly, regarding them all. "I expect only the very best of you. I can't pretend I can guarantee you will all return. But I ask you the one question I have always asked you. Do you want to live forever?" There was a sudden rousing cheer of approval from the ranks, like a close shell burst that made the double-headed eagle up on its perch flap its wings. "Now, get to your stations and begin preparation," said Gaunt. "Dismissed." As the congregation began to dissolve, Paul Corran stepped out of the back rank of the band section and headed towards the nearest exit. A spray of synthetic skin had sealed his cuts and disguised the discoloration, but he had no wish to be in the company of others for longer than was necessary. Now he had information, and it was essential he used it. Beside the elevated platform, Gaunt turned to Hark and Fezekiel. "The men seem to be in good spirits," he remarked, watching them disperse.
"They were inactive on Balhout for too long," said Hark. "And the newcomers are keen to prove themselves?"
"We are indeed," said Fezekiel. "By the way," said Gaunt, "where's Ida?"
"Oh, I haven't seen him since the start of day cycle," said Hark.
Venom Blenner walked into the infirmary section that had been reserved for the regiment's use. There were another three infirmary units aboard to administer to the crew. This suite was old and poorly maintained. It was clearly a backup facility. The chrome and stainless steel surfaces and wall plates were stained with limescale deposits and other less appealing residues. Autoclaves chugged like poorly maintained generator engines. The central examination room radiated into a ward, two surgical theatres and some side chambers for storage and supplies, along with private office spaces for the Medicaid personnel. There was no sign of anybody. Blenner walked into the ward. One cot was occupied. Trooper Fulch from N Company had torn his shoulder, unloading munitions boxes.
"Where are all the doctors?" Blenner asked.
"They were here just a minute ago, sir," said Fulch. Blenner walked back out into the central examination room. Colding suddenly emerged from one of the rear chambers. He was looking for something. He saw Blenner.
"Can I help you?" he asked.
Blenner stared back at the albino, levelly.
"Where's Dawdon? I deal with Dawdon."
Colding stared back at him. His eyes were unreadable behind those damned tinted lenses. He was worse than that damned native partisan Ibrahim insisted on keeping around.
"Dawdon,"
said Blenner, elaborately separating the syllables as though Colding was a simpleton.
"You will have to come back," said Colding. "Thrown, I will. I want to see Dawdon now."
"Colding, what's taking so..." Kurth emerged from the back with an urgent demeanour. She stopped short as soon as she saw Blenner.
"Commissar." "I want to see Dawdon," Blenner said.
Kurth looked quickly at Colding. She took something out of a cabinet drawer and handed it to him.
"Go on," she told him. "I'll be right there."
Colding disappeared back into the rear of the infirmary.
"That man needs training in interpersonal skills," said Blenner.
"How can I help you?" asked Kurth.
"And you need training in basic comprehension," said Blenner. "I want to see Dawdon."
He realised instantly that she wasn't in the mood for playful scolding. Her mood was hard and prickly, even by Anna Kurth standards.
"There's an emergency," she said. "He can't attend you just now. How can I help you?"
Blenner pursed his lips. He wanted Dawdon, but he quite liked the excuse to have to deal with her. His business with Dawdon could probably wait. He took the little bag Welder had given him out of his coat pocket and tossed it to Kurth. She caught it neatly, one-handed.
"What are these?" she asked. "That's what I want you to tell me."
She opened the bag, tipped a couple of the tablets out into her palm, and squinted at them.
"It's a narcotic,"
Somnia. It's a Morphiac derivative. That's a Munitorum pharmaceutical stamp. Where did you get them? They turned up during a routine search. Are they strong? Pretty strong. I mean, I'd think twice about prescribing them. Effective, but addictive. I sometimes use the liquid version as palliative relief on very damaged patients. So, to ease their last hours, huh? Yes, I'd have to have very compelling reasons to issue them otherwise. Perhaps to a patient in chronic pain who is allergic to safer compounds. You found one of the men with these? Yes. Are you missing them? I'd have to check, but I don't think so. We carry such small quantities of this as standard. Less, but one of the other orderlies would have noticed. There is an ongoing problem, though, isn't there? Asked Blenner. Yes, and we're working on it. But it's usually milder sedatives that are easier to misplace. Harder stuff like this is rarer. It could have come out of the ship's supplies. Do you want me to ask the ship's chief medic? No, he said. He paused and then repeated the word. No, I just wanted them identified. Thank you. Well, if that is all, she said. She clearly had somewhere else she wanted to be. I'll take them with me, he said, holding out his hand. I should dispose of them, she replied. Oversight of pharmaceuticals is a Medicaid responsibility. It's still a discipline matter for now, he said. I'll need them back as evidence. She resealed the bag and tossed it across to him. Thank you, he said. He thought about the almost empty bottle in his pocket, but couldn't bring himself to front her up with the question. He didn't want her knowing. He needed to speak to Dordan. Blenner nodded politely and walked out of the infirmary. Kurth issued a deep exhalation of tension and hurried away into the back rooms. In the hallway outside, Blenner collided with the orderly, Lesp, who was rushing towards the infirmary, leading Ayatani Zwiel by the arm. "Watch where you're going!" Blenner explained. He shot a look at Zwiel, expecting some cantankerous barb back. Blenner had been around the regiment long enough to know that the old priest's mouth didn't possess a safety catch. The look on Zwiel's face took him by surprise. Care, anxiety, dread. "What's going on?" Blenner asked. His mind put the pieces together. An empty infirmary, Colding and Kurth trying to get him to leave, the orderly bringing the priest in a hurry. "Oh, throne," said Blenner, and turned back, striding through the infirmary into the back room.
"Wait, please," Lesp called after him.
"Venom, what is your name, Blenner? Show some throne damned respect and don't be an arsehole," Zwiel yelled. They were both rushing after him. Blenner burst into the back office. Kurth looked up from a tray of instruments in surprise, and the surprise quickly turned to despair at the sight of him. Colding was on the far side of the room, administering a shot of something. Dordan had brought a trolley table over when he fell. Gleaming instruments lay scattered across the deck mesh. They'd made him comfortable with bolsters from the daybed, but they hadn't dared lift him. He looked so thin and pale.
"This isn't the time," said Kurth. "What's going on?" Blenner asked. "Could you give the medicae some dignity and leave, please?" she said, coming over to Blenner.
Lesp led Zwiel past them to the old doctor's side.
"Yes, there is no need for you to be here," said Zwiel as he went by.
"Is he dying?" Blenner asked. Dordan was now partially obscured by the figures crouching around him. He hadn't even seemed conscious when Blenner walked in.
"You know he is," Kurth replied quietly.
He could see she was battling to retain her professional composure.
"I mean now," said Blenner. "He's been well for the last week," she said, her voice still low. "Amazingly so. But I think the stress of making shift has taken its toll. He collapsed just now. I think we can stabilise him and get him some bed rest. He shouldn't have come on this mission, said Blenner. It would have been crueler to leave him behind, Kurth replied.
Should Gaunt know? I should get Gaunt.
No, she replied fiercely. He doesn't want that. He doesn't want a fuss. Let him rest. You've brought the damned priest to him, said Blenner. If he's come to administer the imperial grace, then Ibram deserves to... No, she replied. Zweel's his friend. He's been supporting him through this. It seemed right to fetch him here. Gaunt doesn't need this on his mind just now.
Blenner swallowed.
I didn't mean to just burst in, he said. It's all right. Well, you could have said something. I do have a few circumspect bones in my body. I'll bear that in mind, she said. I really should say something to Ibram, said Blenner. If something happens and he finds out I knew, then you don't know, said Kurth. You didn't see anything.
Blenner thought about this and nodded. He turned to go.
Are you all right? He asked.
A tiny flash of surprise crossed her face, as if it never occurred to anybody to ask her that.
Yes, Commissar. Now, get along, so we can work.
Blenner left. Kurth went to Dordan's side.
I think he's stabilised, said Colden quietly. You should take things more easily, said Kurth.
Why?
Whispered Dordan. His voice was the vaguest whisper of dry leaves.
Because doctors make the worst patients, said Kurth.
Actually, Carnodons make the worst patients, said Zweel. I knew a tamer, a circus man, worked the bag of nails on Hagia, and he owned this prefer...
He paused. He saw the looks he was getting.
However, for now, I will stipulate that doctors, in fact, make worse patients than Carnodons.
Dordan managed a tiny smile.
Even Carnodons, let's say, with infected gums that haven't eaten for a week, and then you accidentally leave the cage door open.
Zweel trailed off into a mumble.
Did I hear Blenner's voice?
Dordan asked. He's gone now.
I don't want to fuss, said Dordan.
He's gone, Kurth repeated. He won't say anything.
Nothing to say, said Dordan. I'll be on my feet again in a moment. I'm just tired.
Kurth looked up and saw Lesp trying not to cry.
He probably wants his pills, said Dordan.
His voice was so far away. He beckoned Kurth closer with twig fingers.
He comes to me for a little tonic to settle him. Make sure you look after him, Anna.
I will, she promised. But let's look after you first.
Close to the warp engines, the noise was immense. Everything, every surface, every wall panel, every tooth in a person's head vibrated at an ultra-fast frequency. Layers of armour plate and bulkheads secured the drive chambers. Some sections were sealed chambers where only conditioned servitors or crewmen in protective armour could venture during drive function. Hard, hot yellow light shafted out through the letterbox viewing slits of the reinforced hatches, like the glow from a furnace room port. Vast engineering spaces were filled with dripping, frosty coolant systems, or the black, greased pistons of circulation pumps and galvanic generators. In sooty caverns full of smoke and flame, Ogryn and servitor stokers shoveled granulated promethium resin into the chutes of the combustion generators, the huge conventional turbines that ran the Armaduke's non-drive systems. In other cooler chambers, ancient and perfectly machined emperoscopic rotors spun along horizontal axes, maintaining the ship's spatial equilibrium and helping to sustain the integrity of the Geller field that protected the ship from the psychoreactive fabric of the emeterium. The creature with Paul Corran's face concealed the body of the engineering ensign he had just murdered in a tool locker. and entered the massive engineering chamber containing the Armaduke's Gellerfield device. He'd had to kill three times to get this close. The ship's drive sections were not specifically secure or patrolled, but access or activity by anyone who wasn't officer class or engineering division was immediately noticed. The first crewman had died because he'd seen Corin. His body was now incinerating in a promethium furnace, and Corin was wearing his grimy overalls. The second and third crewmen had died because Corin had needed to extract deck plan specifics and information about the drive deck layout. One was now crumpled at the bottom of a coolant drain, and the other had just been hung by the throat from a hook between stoking shovels and furnace tongs. Sound and vibration in the Gellerfield device chamber was oddly disconcerting. The air was dry, and there was a considerable static field that made his skin prickle. There were rubberized handrails around the chamber so that crewmen could earth themselves and not cause a shock or spark fire off the metal surfaces. He could feel the throb of the machine in his gut, the pulsing of its operation in his sinuses and eyeballs. The device, a piece of technology vital to all warpship function, generated a subatomic field around the ship, a bubble of real space that protected the vessel from the vicissitudes of the ether around it. Once the warp engines had breached the veil of the warp, a starship depended on its Gellerfield to insulate it from the lethal and corrupting touch of the immaterium by maintaining a psychic ward. Corin knew he was in a position to end it all. Sabotaging the Gellerfield device would take some doing and would probably require the use of something explosive or combustible. But he was more than capable of procuring and using either. If he could collapse the Gellerfield while the Armaduke was still in the warp, then the ship would perish. It would be torn apart by the unreality storms of the raw ether, shredding in an instant. Either that, or the demonic essence of the warp would find form and intrude into the ship, or the minds of the occupants. Unwarded, the ship would be vulnerable to the spawn of the realm of chaos, and everyone aboard would know only the extremity of madness before the ruinous powers devoured them. Then everything would be gone and done and finished. The Fegoth and his treachery, the threat that treachery represented, this whole vainglorious undertaking. The creature wearing Paul Corin's face would have completed the mission he was charged to perform by his master, Rhyme, and his master's master, the Anarch. He would have finally stopped the Imperial Guard's determined efforts to deploy the Fegoth, Mabun Etagor, against the armies of the Gower. But during his address, Gaunt had betrayed other secrets. The target was Salvation's Reach. That intelligence needed to be communicated. More importantly, they were due to make conjunction at Tavis Sun. They would be rendezvousing with Battlefleet elements, possibly one of the considerable Crusade fleet packs that were maintaining Imperial superiority in this part of the sector. To destroy the Fegoth and his handlers, and the Armaduke along with it, that was a victory. To achieve all that, and cripple a Battlefleet division, that was a truly worthy opportunity. A more subtle form of sabotage was needed, a more insidious piece of manipulation. His master had taught him well, trained him to improvise imaginatively in just such circumstances, to make the best use of elements at his disposal for the greatest effect. Corin opened the casing of the control circuits that governed the emperoscopic rotors. He was not going to collapse the Gellerfield. He was simply going to alter its rhythm. Something, somewhere, trembled.
"What was that?"
asked Shipmaster Spiker. None of the bridge crew answered him directly. Copious quantities of data shunted through their connective links and displayed across the monitor plates. The air was filled with the dry, scratchy voices of Voxlinks talking to each other. He'd felt a minuscule vibration, an almost subliminal palsy. It had come to him through the deck, through the data stream of the ship, one tiny aberrant shudder, in a constant vortex of noises and rhythms and pulses and information. He consulted his data viewers and asked questions of his cogitators. Nothing seemed wrong. Nothing out of place. Not within the margins of operation, and certainly not given the temperamental and mercurial nature of an old warp ship like the Highness Sir Armaduke. Spica sat back and thought. It had probably been nothing, or a fleeting glitch that had corrected itself. But it was a nothing he hadn't liked at all. Cavity 29617 was cold. Mert had been waiting there for about half an hour, unwilling to practice or set up shots, unwilling to leave. He sat at one end of the long chamber, arms hugged around the old rifle.
"You are here? Good."
Sar Aff was standing behind him. Mert got up quickly.
"You told me to come back," he said. "And you have proven you can follow instruction," said the White Scar.
He reached out a hand and grabbed Mert by the jaw and throat, turning Mert's head to the side. Mert struggled again.
"Let me go!"
"This jaw, it is definitely your problem," said Saraf. "You are being defeated by your own concentration. Your focus is so intense that as you fire the gun, it stimulates..."
"Yes, yes, you told me all this yesterday."
Saraf let him go. "It is physically impossible for you to shoot well."
Mert swallowed.
"Again, you told me so yesterday. Did you ask me back just so you could humiliate me?"
Saraf stuck out his chin as if considering a response. He turned away.
"Set up a shot," he said.
Mert stood for a moment, then picked up several tin pots and walked the length of the cavity. He set the pots out along the top of the block and walked back to where the space marine was waiting. Saraf had produced something from an equipment pouch. Mert realised that it was a disposable shot injector, just a second before the White Scar grabbed his head again and jammed it into his jawline behind his left ear. The pain was considerable. Mert cried out and staggered backwards, his eyes watering.
"What the faith are you doing?"
he asked.
"Just wait."
Saraf took the injector and tossed it away. Mert had a lancing pain in his ear and a horrible warmth spreading through the line of his throat and his jaw. He started to gag slightly as the numbness increased.
"Attend to yourself," said Saraf. "You are drooling.
What have you done to me? What was that stuff?"
"Muscle relaxant," said the White Scar innocently. "Quite powerful, I suppose. A tranquilizer, the sort of stuff a medicae would use for pain control. During an amputation, for instance."
Clutching his throbbing, disturbed face, Mert looked at the space marine in horror.
"Bah, relax," said Saraf. "I am not going to cut anything off. Not literally."
Mert tried to answer, but he only managed to make a deep and inhuman rumbling in his throat. His entire jaw and cheek was numbed and immobile. The lower half of his face was inert and paralysed.
"The jaw," said Saraf, gesturing towards Mert. "That jaw of yours, it is the root of your inability."
The space marine went over and picked up the old rifle.
"You are being defeated by your own concentration," he said as he came back,
as though he were repeating some litany lesson that needed to be repeated so that an unwilling student might eventually learn it.
"Your focus is so intense that as you fire the gun, you twitch. So, we need to remove the jaw from the equation. It cannot twitch if it cannot twitch."
Mert felt ill. The paralysis was so unpleasant that he felt he might be sick, except he couldn't guarantee that his mouth would open to allow it. Visions of choking on his own vomit filled his head and made things worse.
"Take the shot," said Saraf, handing him the rifle.
Mert glared back at him, hoping his toxic stare might communicate what his voice could not.
"Take the shot,"
Saraf repeated. Mert took a deep breath. He pulled back the bolt, took a round from his pocket, slipped it into the breech, locked the bolt back into place, then turned and lined up on the row of pots. A standing stance, unbraced apart from his own posture. No rest, no sand sock, no tripod, no back brace. Neither a recommended nor reliable position. He didn't care.
"Go on," said Saraf. "Take the shot."
Mert settled his shoulders. He felt spittle in his lip, the dull throb of numbness under his ear. He took aim along the iron sights. He breathed out. He fired.